The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
So the question was, do you know with confidence, with any certainty, what the consequences of such an intervention would be? And I would say, no, I don't know for sure what would happen if we don't intervene. I do know for sure what will happen if we don't intervene. And I'm not a rocket scientist. I don't even speak Arabic. And there are others who know this region far more profoundly than I do, who had the same views. And basically, as a consequence of our adamant refusal, adamant, stubborn, dogmatic refusal to do anything about the Syrian situation, right? We are now witnessing the most defining humanitarian crisis of our time. It dwarfs Bosnia. A defining strategic crisis. All you have to do is look at where Syria is on the map, and according to the most cold-hearted Kissingerian calculus, you would feel impelled to act. We are witnessing human suffering that is simply unbearable to watch. We are witnessing the destabilization of various European countries. I mean, it is simply astonishing.
I'm Cody Poplin, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, February 20th, 2016. That was the voice of Leon Wieseltier expressing his frustrations with the United States' policy in Syria and towards those fleeing the violence in that country. Wieseltier, who among many other things, is the Isaiah Berlin Senior Fellow in Culture and Policy at the Brookings Institution, is currently completing an essay on the moral, historical, and philosophical dimensions of the refugee crisis. During his conversation with Lawfare Editor-in-Chief Ben Wittes, Wieseltier argues that the United States has a moral obligation to do more to alleviate the plight of Syrian refugees, and that the U.S.'s refusal to act is the great foreign policy failing of our time. According to Wieseltier, the United States must be more than just the world's most powerful bystander. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode number 158, Leon Wieseltier on the moral dimensions of the Syrian refugee crisis.
So let me just start with a kind of broadside question. Why should we think about the refugee problems principally in the language of morality and obligation, rather than in the language of absorptive capacity and interests?
The beginning of the answer is because we're moral beings and we should think about all questions that have moral dimensions in moral terms. Questions that have moral dimensions do not have only moral dimensions, and obviously the conditions under which you execute your moral obligations or implement them will matter. But the idea that we have a choice in certain moral situations not to behave morally because it would inconvenience us materially or politically or otherwise flies in the face of our conception of ourselves as ethical agents. It seems that much seems perfectly clear to me. If you're religious, if you're secular, there are traditions there are ethical traditions that tell you that when the stranger is in trouble, you make room. Room was made for us. We are all people in this country, who are almost all people, who are descended from people for whom room was made. The moral dimension is the first dimension that needs to be addressed. Now, when you get to the question of, well, how do we implement our moral obligations, there are things to talk about. But the answer can't be we don't, and it can't be that we implement them in such a way
as would not fulfill our moral obligation.
So what do you how would you describe our moral obligations here? And to what extent would you distinguish between the moral obligations of Europe and the moral obligations of the United States?
There's a lot to be said about that. In the first place, I think that the obligation to help refugees is a universal moral obligation, or as Kant put it, when he actually introduced the idea of a universal right in 1795, it was the right of hospitality that we must extend to strangers. I think that, to begin with, I think it's a universal obligation. Secondly, I think as Americans, we have a national moral obligation for two reasons. The first being that we are, even though we keep saying it almost to the point of cliche and boredom, a nation of immigrants. We are hyphenated people. We all come from somewhere else.
But a nation of immigrants and a nation of refugees is not quite the same thing.
Well,
right?
We've taken in both. We've taken in both. Refugees are not the same as immigrants, but they're a more intense and more urgent kind of immigrant. The idea that we have been a place, I've always thought of the United States as the place that all the other people in the world think of as their second act. I always think of the United States. The United States has historically given a sense of possibility to people around the world and a sense of hope. And I am the descendants of people who came to these shores in that spirit, not as immigrants, but as refugees. Not that the United States has to act a certain way because of my parents, but the fact is that we have been a country that takes in others, and not just takes in others grudgingly, but actually regards taking in others as a reinvigoration of our society and our economy and our culture, despite all the nativist resistance that exists to it and so on. But we actually, you know, we don't take in immigrants, we haven't historically, we don't take in immigrants and refugees merely because we have to. We actually regard them as lucky breaks for our country. And history shows that that is a correct analysis. The second reason that we have a national moral obligation, in my view, towards the Syrian refugees is that they are crossing the Mediterranean in desperation, in part as a consequence of our inaction in Syria.
So
we are one of the causes of their desperation, not the only cause.
So do you mean here that you don't feel the same way or to the same degree about, North African migrants in Europe? Is that a question of degree, or is it a...
At some level, I guess I do. Look, you know, Obama famously said in an interview with... there used to be a magazine called The New Republic. I don't know if you remember it.
You know, I...
But anyway...
I think I applied for an internship
there. He said that if he chose to act in Syria, then he would have to act in Congo, and where does it end? My own view is that whereas we can't be and we won't be the constabulary of the world, so that we are not responsible for every terrible fate that befalls everyone in the world, we can't also be the world's most powerful bystander. And our power actually imposes certain responsibilities on us. I mean, if you are walking near a lake and you see someone drowning, right? The people who have an obligation to rescue that person are the people who know how to swim, who have the power to swim. If you can't swim, I don't expect you to jump into the lake, because then we'll have two drowning people. But the power to rescue is another dimension of obligation. You know, it's the people who can rescue who should rescue. And it's certainly true that in the Syrian conflict, and we're not going to go into that right now, our refusal to consequentially support any side, whereas when all the other actors were being very consequentially supported, is one of the reasons that the people who are now flooding into Europe felt the despair that they felt. I mean, we know that people who take their kids on dinghies on the high seas, people who endanger their children only do so because they feel that otherwise their children would be more endangered than that.
So I think that for all these reasons, I think the United States, we have a moral responsibility.
So,
and we should be proud of it, actually. Now we're living in a political climate that is, you know, that begrudges us our moral duties. That sort of half wishes, or in some cases, all wishes that we didn't have these duties.
So my question, I guess, hearing that is, what's the limit on the duty? Is there, I mean...
Let me say two things about that. One,
if you have, to be difficult about it, if you have a small wealthy population and a huge amount of space, say Sweden or Finland,
who are, you know, acquitting themselves brilliantly.
I mean, but you could theoretically take an unlimited number of refugees. You could double the population. You'd have some absorption issues, but you could theoretically do it. So my question is, how much the obligation to make space involves? How much? How much space do you have to make?
I don't know a way to quantify that, and I will say that I know you're not asking this question in this spirit, though maybe perversely you are, but the question itself is often asked as a way of shutting down the discussion. It's a bit like people who want to begin the discussion of Israeli-Palestinian peace with the status of Jerusalem. That is a way of preventing the discussion from taking place. Whatever the number is, we are in no danger of approaching it right now.
And
we have taken 2,500 Syrian refugees, approximately, since the Syrian war began. That's 2011, that's 5 years. When we get to the point at which it may be plausibly argued that we're taking in too many, that will be a very interesting conversation to have. And there's no question that rescue should not put the rescuers in need of rescue. In other words, there is part of the moral calculus here, again, is that you don't relieve suffering by causing suffering,
right?
Because then you've just added to the suffering in the world. But as I say, the question of what sort of suffering, the admission and resettlement and absorption of Syrian refugees in certain numbers would cause, is an interesting question. It's a fabulously demagogic question, as you can tell from the reality show called The Republican Debates. But it's not a relevant question yet. And that question, again, maybe not when you ask it, but when others ask it, is designed to make nothing possible, is designed to shut it down. Because if I help you, I have to help everybody. You know, it's that kind of perverse Kantian reasoning used for precisely the opposite ends that Kant had when he proposed such ideas.
So in defense of perhaps a small percentage of people who ask this question, I want to make a defense of it, which is that I think it's a lot easier for people to contemplate doing X if they know that the coefficient on X is not infinite, right? And it's a lot easier for them to say, I'm happy for the United States or for Germany to take a lot of refugees if they're confident that the allot is not infinitely elastic and that they understand what some limiting principle involved is. And I actually think what you just sketched out is an interesting one, that it's the point at which societal benefit turns into some harm, such that the rescuer then has to be, in some sense,
rescued
himself. But it's
complicated because in the name of rescue, for the sake of rescue, we may indeed have to inconvenience ourselves. And the question then becomes, what is the difference between inconvenience? Where does inconvenience become harm? And it's an interesting question.
Right.
It's an interesting question. It is not the case that every job that every refugee will get could have gone to an unemployed American. It is the case that some of them might have.
So I'm thinking here about, you know, the example that I always think about in this context is the Mariel boat lift, where I think if you think about the Mariel boat lift in 1983, we are talking almost entirely about the degree of inconvenience. Mm-hmm. We brought in, among other things, a lot of criminals. We brought in a lot of social problems in South Florida. And if you
I saw a Scarface. Yeah,
and if you look at that community today, it is very hard to see the Mariel boat lift as anything other than a terrific thing for Florida and a terrific thing
for... Between 1880 and 1924, the United States took in 4 million Italian immigrants. Among those 4 million, we got Enrico Fermi, Frank Sinatra, Joe DiMaggio, the late Antonin Scalia, and Al Capone. right? Does anyone...
We got Toscanini, too.
Well, we got all kinds of people, but we got Al Capone, and we got Lucky Luciano, and we got all of them. Does anyone in their right mind think that we shouldn't have taken in that wonderful immigrant community because the mafia came in with it? Of course not. Of course not. The problem is that the president and the Democrats do not have the spine, the courage, to explain to Americans why they should not panic about the security problem.
So I am in almost total agreement with you on the American side. And I look at, you know, I look at the risks that we assume through the refugee problems, refugee program, as so subsumed by the risks of routine visa granting that it's a kind of a rounding error sort of problem.
Yeah.
I might feel differently about it if I were a European, however, where you're talking about the large-scale admission of very large numbers of people, essentially unvetted, and they've already seen, most notably in Cologne, a certain degree of disruption to what they think of reasonably as sort of the social fabric as a result. And so I'm wondering how you think the moral calculation changes if you're Germany and you're contemplating refugees by the millions or hundreds of thousands rather than, you know, the United States, where you get to knock two decimal points off of that.
The problem in Europe is that their tradition of national identity has no natural understanding of a multi-ethnic society. That's the problem. According to traditional European nationalism, the political boundaries and the cultural boundaries should ideally coincide. In the nation state, the state should personify a nation, and the nation should be incarnated in a state. And as I say, the boundaries should coincide so that you have a series of happy, homogeneous societies living side by side. Now, of course, the boundaries never coincide. So Europe had this thing known as the problem of minorities, which became extremely exacerbated after World War I. But what Europe never had is any natural understanding of a multi-ethnic society. And not only does Europe have no natural understanding of that, but the problem of difference and otherness has historically been Europe's Achilles heel, morally speaking, going all the way back. Europe has a cultural problem with difference, with otherness. And I think what's going to happen now, I do not think that that problem is admirable, to put it mildly. I think the idea that national cultures, specific cultures, can only flourish in an environment, in a completely homogeneous environment, in which any confrontation with the other would be a form of pollution or contamination, is deeply false. In fact, we know historically that particular cultures actually flourish from collisions with other cultures, from mutual influences and cross-fertilizations and so on. But the purest European ideal is what's being threatened right now by this exodus, by this onrush of immigrants. And as I say, I don't think the ideal is admirable. I think the ideal conflicts with the kind of moral obligations, universal moral obligations that I was speaking about before. Universal moral obligations, as I noted, that, by the way, were first enunciated by an 18th century German philosopher. And so I think what will happen in Europe is that the result of this immigrant crisis in Europe, there can be two possible solutions. Either Europe will finally break through to some understanding of multi-ethnicity, or we will see a revival of European fascism. I think those are the two likely alternatives. The war over cultural homogeneity, the war over their tradition of the nation state, the war over their fantasy of monocultural, monoethnic group life is going to be a very fierce war. And the government in Poland and in Slovakia and in Hungary and Le Pen and some of the opposition to Merkel right now, what they're doing is reviving some of the old European traditions of this sort. So you have there a different as it were, moral, cultural picture. I don't think it in any way absolves them of their obligation to take in the stranger, but I recognize the trauma that the stranger has always represented to European societies. I don't admire it. My parents came to this country as a result of Europe's inability to tolerate others. But I think, as I say, that's what we're witnessing. That's what we're witnessing. And that is something entirely different from the question of the absorptive capacities of, the question of whether what your relationship should be to the stranger in need, whether you should welcome immigrants, whether the company of the other is in fact a good thing and not a bad thing, the proximity of the other. Those questions have nothing to do with the absorptive capacities of an economy or a city or a township or so on. Those are other questions. Those are other questions. So in Europe, yes, this is spectacularly traumatic. Now, the difference is that when Orban in Hungary enunciates public philosophies of nativism, he is in fact representing and reviving an old European tradition. This is a way of being European. We know about this, right? When Trump or Cruz enunciates a certain kind of hateful nativism, it is true that there are American traditions of nativism, but in fact, what they are actually doing is defying the American ethos.
Well, and they're reviving a movement that has lost at almost every stage.
And been disproved after its loss.
However, that has a peculiarly persistent life as dissent in, whether it's in the 1830s about Germans or whether it's in 1924.
The same reasons are being given now. I went and looked at the reasons that were given for not letting the St. Louis dock. And then I went and read the entire protocols of the Avignon Conference in 1938. And the very same reasons are being given. Who are these people? There are criminals among them. They're foreigners. They'll take jobs. They'll take our jobs. After all, the Depression was a very recent memory. In fact, it was actually, in certain crises, was actually still a reality.
Okay, so in one thing that was not true in 1938 and was, not true in this country at the time of the Voyage of the Damned, right, was that there had been attacks like the Paris attack. And intelligence assessments by apparently reasonable people that there was a decision by ISIS to infiltrate.
But I'm not sure that's true. I mean, in nativists in America at the time, in the late 19th century, regarded anarchist violence in this country as the work of Italian immigrants,
which
brought
it
with them. I mean, we don't really know. That's what Sacco Vanzetti was about. So actually, there were precedents for this.
So you don't see ISIS and the possibility that ISIS will infiltrate refugee flows, or even the likelihood.
No, let me tell you, our vetting process takes so long that if you were ISIS, you'd find a quicker way.
No. I'm talking about Europe now. That I think a reasonable European does get to say, wait a minute, we just had Paris. We've had, repeated threats of stuff like that in every European capital. We had to shut down Brussels for
four or five days.
Yeah. We don't know when the next thing's happening. The last thing we need to do is to bring in a large group of people from precisely the country that has generated, the countries that have generated this particular movement.
I understand the perception, and I understand the point as an expression of fear, as an expression of emotion. I think that there are also large, that attached to that fear is also some prejudice. I think that the question of the absorption and successful integration or lack thereof of Muslim populations in various Western states did not begin with this refugee crisis, and it has a complicated background. I do think that the vast majority, in fact, I don't know anyone who doesn't think that the overwhelming majority of the people who are fleeing to Europe are not terrorists. They're victims of terrorism. Now, is this some kind of supreme irony? Maybe it is, but I don't think that irony vitiates the moral obligation. I think this is a job for police work. And I don't think that all, you know, I mean, that police problems, you know, it's politics that raises certain police problems into existential problems. That's the role of politics. That's what politicians do. Sometimes there are just police problems. And I think that, again, the overwhelming majority of these people are fleeing terrorism, are Western-oriented people. It's obvious. And I think it's even visually obvious. I mean, this may sound naive, but I look at the pictures of these immigrants, and, you know, they're dressed in Benetton. They're wearing khakis, for God's sake. They're not wearing five keffiyehs with suicide bombs strapped. You know, they're not fat around their waist in an overcoat. I mean, you know, but seriously, I mean, I understand there's a fear, but one has to think rationally about fear and about risk.
So I want to pose an admittedly obnoxious question about fear and risk, not in the spirit of shutting down the discussion, but in the spirit of being very frank.
Yeah.
I believe that if we admit a large number of people, there will be costs to that in terrorism domestically. I have argued publicly, and I stand by it, that we should do it anyway because of the moral obligations.
I agree with that. But again,
my question is, what sort of, like, for me, there is some level of violence that would result from the policy that I've advocated that would make me say, maybe I was too open. And so I'm saying, what's a tolerable level of cost to you, and what's an intolerable level of cost to you?
I'm not sure how to answer that question, because I'm not going to play fast and loose with the lives of Americans. Our obligation is also to our own security. Security is also a moral obligation. I would say this. First, I am much more concerned about what we call homegrown violence, about the use of the diabolical new technology in creating terrorists, people who not only are not immigrants but have never been to Syria, haven't come back, but have a computer. And are unhappy.
I read a book about this once.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, exactly. But I mean, you know, if you're unhappy and you have a computer, then there are lots of final solutions that you can find for your unhappiness. I worry a lot about that. I also think that we already have homegrown terrorists that have nothing to do with immigrants. Ideologically inspired terrorism, abortion clinics, Planned Parenthood. That's, I'm not saying it's religious, but it's ideologically inspired terrorism. I don't want to seem glib, but I do think that the risk of violence, whatever it is small, and that's a risk that we tolerate. I mean, we tolerate the risk of violence and the risk of physical pain, a small risk in many other realms of life, and the moral obligation is very great. And the FBI has a lot of work to do, because the corks are popping all over the world and populations are moving. And, you know, we're living in one of history's plastic moments. And one way to put that is that the FBI has a lot of work to do. But I don't think that the entire problem of immigrants should be seen as an FBI problem or as a security problem. I really don't. Again, you know, I feel it's a different problem, but when I advocate using American troops abroad, I'm putting Americans in harm's way, right? And I always have to deal with the question, well, what am I, where does my anxiety about the security of American soldiers fall in the moral calculus that allows me to advocate their deployment abroad? And that's complicated. That's complicated. So there are these complicated moral calculus, but I don't think that the immigration, I think it's demagogic and politically self-interested for people on the right. And in keeping with some of our ugliest traditions, to view the immigration problem solely through the standpoint either of Islam or of security. First, Islam and security not being coterminous, of course. So I guess that's my answer.
So I want to, before we wrap up, I want to ask about your view of the domestic American politics of this. A lot of people have waxed indignant at the rhetoric of the Donald Trumps of the world. You've reserved a lot of anger for Barack Obama.
Yeah.
And I'm interested, first of all, why Obama has become a figure of such opprobrium for you in this discussion. But secondly, whether there's any national level political figure who you look at and say, that person really speaks for me on this subject, save for Angela Merkel.
Not right now. Right now, the American discussion of the refugee question is a discussion between nativists and xenophobes who won't do anything for the refugees and high-minded liberals who won't do anything for the refugees.
So unpack that a little bit.
Look, the United States has taken in 2,500 since the war started. Since the exodus started in the fall, I think we've taken in 300 plus. My understanding is that the UN had already referred 16,000 Syrian refugees to the United States for admission, so that the procedure should start, the slow wheels should start slowly turning before the exodus in the fall. We agreed to take 10,000 more. If we do take those 10,000 more, that'll be 10,000 off the 16,000 that were already on a list. We will have done nothing to alleviate this crisis. Now, I think we are the United States of America. One of the reasons I love my country is because of its magnanimity towards people like refugees, partly for biographical reasons, but also I think it makes us better than countries that aren't like this. And I actually would like to live in a better country, morally speaking, and not in a worse country. And I would like to raise my child in such a country. So I think that being the United States of America, you know, it is not unreasonable to expect of us during such an emergency to actually extend our hand the way we were supposed to do to the mullahs in Tehran, right? To actually extend our hand, right? We are not extending our hand. Obama makes lofty speeches, and we do nothing. We do nothing. Right? You know, our failure during the debate about action, American policy in Syria, I was one of those people, and still am actually, who argued for American intervention, for the use of force, proxy force, and sometimes direct American force. And it was a very bitter debate, as you remember. And I was always asked, because that's the question now, do you know with any certainty what the consequences of an intervention would be? Because, you know, now the American government is not allowed to do anything abroad unless it knows what will happen 50 steps ahead, right? Unless we can tell the future, the prospect of unintended consequences is enough to shut it all down. Never mind that there isn't anything we do in life, like crossing DuPont Circle, without running the risk of unintended consequences. So the question was, do you know with confidence, with any certainty, what the consequences of such an intervention would be? And I would say, no, I don't know for sure what would happen if we don't intervene. I do know for sure what will happen if we don't intervene. And I'm not a rocket scientist. I don't even speak Arabic. And there are others who know this region far more profoundly than I do, who had the same views. And basically, as a consequence of our adamant, stubborn, dogmatic refusal to do anything about the Syrian situation, right, we are now witnessing the most defining humanitarian crisis of our time. It dwarfs Bosnia. A defining strategic crisis. All you have to do is look at where Syria is on the map and according to the most cold-hearted Kissingerian calculus, you would feel impelled to act. We are witnessing human suffering that is simply unbearable to watch. We are witnessing the destabilization of various European countries. I mean, it is simply astonishing what is happening because we refuse to offer any resistance to any of it. Now, would none of this have happened? I don't know. Would all of this have happened just the way it had if the United States had chosen to offer some resistance to some of these? I'm quite certain that the answer is no. And so I regard Obama as having completely destroyed, delegitimated the American tradition of humanitarian intervention as a consequence of his view of the war of Iraq, which would take 50 podcasts to analyze, as a consequence of certain prior views he holds about the role of America in the world and the use of American power in the world, which he never articulates. But I regard him as having single-handedly destroyed this conception of the American role in the world. Some people admire him for it. Some people admire him for it. I detest him for it. And I think that the consequences of his indifference, though of course we're supposed to think that every morning he wakes up in the White House and is anguished about what's happening. But I've always wondered if he does nothing, then what difference is there between his anguish and his lack of anguish? I remember, I'll tell you a story, we could finish with this if you want. In 1993, on the day that the Holocaust Museum opened, my parents were invited down. They were Holocaust survivors, and we sat and we listened to Bill Clinton, it was during the Bosnia crisis, say, never again, we must never again let this happen in Bosnia. What's happening in Bosnia is the first time since World War II that we see concentration camps. Never again can we allow this to happen. And my sweet and very smart mother turned to me and whispered, you know, he talks about Bosnia like he's somebody else. Meaning that the American president is the one person on the planet we don't need eloquence from. We need him to pick up the phone. We need him to pick up the phone because he has the power.
So I assume you see no hope on this score from Bernie Sanders.
I see no hope on this.
But what about Hillary Clinton?
I think Hillary Clinton is hopeful in the way that one always hopes about situationists, that they'll do the right thing. I think that Hillary Clinton mystifies me. It's something of an achievement to have been in public life for 25 years and still not have the country know quite who you are. On foreign policy, it's clear to me that she's capable of using American power. On the night before she dispatches American troops somewhere, she won't have to stay up all night begging forgiveness from the ghosts of Country Joe and the Fish, right? She seems perfectly aware of the realities of power. She is herself in some way a creature of power, temperamentally. I don't know exactly what she believes in foreign policy. She did strongly advocate our arming the moderate Syrian rebels when I believe it would have made a difference, along with Petraeus and Panetta, when Obama turned them down. So I have reason to believe that she is more likely to fulfill my much despised conception of what our role in the world should be. But I don't know.
And when you look at the Republican side, controlling for the overtly nativist caucus, do you see anybody speaking for a kind of liberal interventionism as you imagine?
Controlling for lunacy, I think that, I think Rubio understands it. I think Rubio understands it. I mean, the problem on the Republican side is, look, I've never voted happily in a general election once in my life. It's always lesser evil time. And when I was a young man, until the Soviet Union fell, I was primarily a foreign policy national security voter because the existence of the Soviet Union seemed to me the most overwhelming fact in the world in terms of the United States and its fortunes. Between the fall of the Berlin Wall and the fall of the World Trade Center, I permitted myself to vote not always on foreign policy national security grounds. After the fall of the World Trade Center, I'm afraid I'm a little bit back to that. So, I mean, there are one or two Republicans who might fulfill my idea of how American power should be used in the world, but the cost in their domestic positions are so high for me that it's just excruciating. What's happened is that, for better or worse, all the consensuses have broken down. There are interventionists and isolationists among Republicans and among Democrats, and you know, there is the Iraq War has cast the longest shadow. I mean, you know, Vietnam syndrome, the helicopter left the roof of that building in Saigon in 1975. Reagan was elected in 80, so it lasted 5 years. Whatever you think about it, maybe people would wish that it would lasted forever. Whatever you think about it, Obama still cannot order the spaghetti unless he knows that George W. Bush didn't order the spaghetti, because if he did, he's got to order the linguine. So we're living, you know, there are reasons for it, but I think that right now, I think the next president is going to have to reconstitute American foreign policy, not just in Syria. I think that Obama...
And not just with respect to refugees.
Not just with respect to refugees. Obama went from overreach to underreach without stopping at reach, is what he did. And wherever you go in the world, people are always saying, where are the Americans? Wherever you go, the pivot to Asia didn't happen. Right, there's a reason to pivot. Well, first of all, the pivot happened,
which is not the Asia part.
But nothing happened. Also, the idea that we have to pivot with the United States of America in the 1970s. Again, whatever you think of the policies, Kissinger did the opening to China, negotiations between Israel and Egypt and other Arab states, and arms control and other talks with the Soviet Union. We've got to do a lot of things at the same time. I mean, this idea that we're done with the Middle East, we're going to Asia, it's the 21st century, so the 20th century is completely over. All these ex cathedra a priori notions that fill Obama's brain seem completely unvalidated by history to me. So I think we're now in a moment in which the fundamental principles of American foreign policy are in play. The level of the debate, unfortunately, might not indicate that. But given the fact that that history is in overdrive, and that there are crises everywhere, and given the fact that, as I said, the consensuses have broken down as regards parties and so on, and given the long overhang of the Iraq War, et cetera, we are now at a real moment of truth about our conception of our place in the world. And they can't all be right. They can't all be right. And so we're going to see. Obama has no doubt in my mind that Obama believes that the United States has no moral rights, directly or indirectly, to be responsible for an outcome decisively in another country. No moral right. It is clear to me that Barack Obama believes that, on balance, the use of American force abroad has not been for good. He would say that it had mixed results, but in my view, mixed results in this life is a win. In private life, in public life, in foreign policy, mixed results, that's a lot. In my view, Obama believes that the 20th century and its problems have been retired, and we're now headed for a foreign policy that will have to deal primarily, as he said, with Ebola and climate change. I'm all for dealing with Ebola and climate change, but one thing that strikes one about the present moment in foreign policy is how many very traditional and recognizable problems are appearing throughout the world. Revolutionary movements, terrorism, aggression by states against other states, weakening alliances.
Large-scale movements.
Large-scale population movements. All of it. These are classical problems. These are classical problems. You know, history is not over yet. And, you know, Obama thinks he's some sort of ambassador from the future. But the future is now. This is what the future looks like. I mean, we're here. So, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I know we didn't come to talk about this, but you asked.
Thanks very much for coming in.
It was a pleasure.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, please spread the word and promote the Lawfare Podcast on your social networks, Twitter, Facebook, email, and in any other way you can. Thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.